Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Mindful Clinician podcast. It's been a little bit, a couple weeks, I think. I have no like set schedule for when I'm going to record these. It's kind of just whenever I feel like it. So I'm back. And last time I recorded on my computer, because I have a fancy microphone, shout out to my friend Taylor, who sent me this when we were doing our own podcast together. And last time I recorded, it didn't save right away. So I freaked out and I re-recorded it on my phone on the app that I use to publish the podcast episodes. And then later that night, I saw that it actually did save. So I'm just hoping, all of that to say, I'm hoping that this actually does save. And if it does, this is pointless information. I guess you didn't really need to know this. It has nothing to do with the podcast episode. Okay. On my Instagram account at themindful.clinician, a couple weeks ago, I did a little poll, and I was like, what do you guys want to hear about? It's been a little bit since I've been podcasting, and I have never done a podcast for this particular, audience, I'll say. So I wanted to hear from you guys and, you know, see what you guys wanted to hear about. And most of you guys voted on ICU treatments. So we can get into that for sure. I think that's a really good topic. I'm really excited to talk about it. And I want to give a little bit of a background on like my, you know, for those who haven't listened to maybe the first episode, I want to give like a little bit of a background to where I work and what I do and all that stuff. So I'm a certified occupational therapy assistant. I work in acute care. So I work at a hospital. It's a level one trauma center. We have two ICUs. We have a surgical ICU and a medical ICU in my hospital. And I will go to both. It took a little bit for me to get up there when I first got hired. And they wanted to kind of train their new employees up on the ICU. This was just within our department, not like a hospital-wide, policy or something or anything like that, which I was fine with because the ICU is very intimidating. Like to me, it was very, very intimidating for obvious reasons. Like these patients are more critically ill. There's a lot more like lines and drains and things to look out for. And, you know, so that was scary. And I, and something that I learned is that like the ICU, the patient to nurse ratio is less. So a nurse up there will have less patients than like a med surge floor. So typically the nurses are usually within reach a lot faster than a med surge floor where they have more patients. So that was comforting. And I'll get into some of the other stuff later too, but, so I had received some training from one of the OTs at my job, and there was like an online training. It was basically a continuing ed course that I watched regarding like ICU treatments and what to look out for and stuff like that. And then I did in-person training, like treatment observations with this OT. And there were times where I would watch her treat. There were other times where I kind of acted as like the aide and I would help her out. And then there were other times where she just kind of watched me treat and just signed off on like the competency. So one of the biggest things I'll say about the ICU is for me, if you're lucky enough to have an aide at your job, sign the aide up for the ICU treatments, unless it's a patient you've seen before and they are like, you know, standby assist and they're about to leave the ICU to go to the med surge floor. That's the only time I won't bring an aide. But if it's a patient that I've never seen before, even if they're like min assist from the eval, I'll bring an aide because there's so many lines. Sometimes they might be on oxygen. They might have more IVs. They might just have like a lot, probably a Foley catheter. Like there's just a lot of stuff that you're going to see up there, and they have more than the med surg floor. So I can't really manage a patient, especially if they're like mod assist, max assist, and manage the lines at the same time. So that's why the aide is helpful. And to me, it's just like a comfort knowing that like I am not the only one in the room with the the patient. And of course, if you've been on the ICU, you know what the rooms look like. If you haven't, they are not your typical room on a med-surg floor. It's not it there's not a door that you open that like gives the person privacy. There's like a screen sliding glass door, and of course there's a curtain that you can close if the for privacy reasons, but it's a different type of room setup. And so sometimes I'll even like just leave that open and then close the curtain. It's different than like a med-surg. And also like all of the rooms, at least this is in my hospital, but I think this is true for like I've worked in a couple different hospitals, and it was the same. The nurse's station kind of faces all of the rooms, so it's nice because you could just like holler if you needed something. So what else? I was going to It's funny, I was gonna like plan out a little, what do you call it, outline of things that I was gonna talk about. And I did not. So we're gonna wing it today. And then maybe I'll do a part two if there's stuff that I missed. So typically, like I was saying, I'll have an aide with me. The nurse is usually like right there. And a lot of times the nurse will be, I've had treatment sessions where the nurse is like in the room charting on the computer, and I'm just like working with the patient. So that's always helpful. It's always nice to have a second set of eyes on the patient, depending on what they're there for. The surgical ICU, patients will go there after like having a surgery, and they need to be monitored on the ICU and whatnot. And then the medical ICU is different types of patients. These are patients who come in and they're just like critically ill, but maybe they didn't have a surgery. I don't really know the exact criteria for why they go to which floor, but both of them can be equally challenging because they're more, like I was saying, critically ill, and they need a lot more monitoring. Their vitals are extra important. Like in the hospital setting, we're taking vitals all the time anyway. But in the ICU, it's even more important to like be on the lookout for what their blood pressure is and what the parameters are that are set by the doctor. And if you don't know, if you work in a hospital where that's not something that's clearly seen in the EMR, I would ask the nurse. I would ask the yeah, I would ask start with asking the nurse, like, hey, what are the blood pressure parameters? Like, what should I look out for if I'm going to get this patient up, or out of bed to like the chair or something like that. So that's a big one. The beeping noises, there's constant beeping noises in the ICU. There just is. If it's a noise that I've heard before, I can silence it. Like if they're, I don't know, if their oxygen dips a little bit, it'll beep. And so then we'll just wait for it to come up, but I can silence that noise. If it's a noise that I've never heard of, or if it's an IV that's beeping, I will get the nurse in there and have them obviously like take a look at it and see what's going on. Okay. So I also wanted to go into like some of the things you can see. So on my Instagram a couple weeks ago, I did like a little questionnaire thing, and I showed a picture of what's called an EVD. So it's an external ventricular drain. And I was like, who knows what this is? And a lot of you guys got it right. And that what that does is it drains excess cerebral spinal fluid, CSF, in the ventricles that builds up after like trauma or a stroke, things like that. So it drains that. And then on the monitor, the screen that shows like their heart rate, their blood pressure, their oxygen, it will also show their ICP, so their intracranial pressure. And that is something that like the parameters for that, I always forget like what the norm is, but it'll beep if it's like too high or too low or something like that. So that's when you can just again call the nurse. Like the nurse on the ICU is going to be your best friend. Because we didn't learn that in school. I didn't learn what the exact parameters were for some of these things. So what else was I going to say? See, this is why having an outline would have been nice, but in true Kelsey fashion, I just hit record. So, okay, so with the EVD, you don't touch that. I never touch that. That's something that has to be handled by the nurse. I know it has to be clamped before before the patient moves. And it's always a good idea to just, I mean, I'm constantly communicating with the nurse saying like, "Hey, I'm going to see your patient at this time. Is that a good time?" Depending on your system at your hospital, the way you communicate or when you communicate with the nurse might be different, but especially with an ICU patient, especially a patient who has like this EVD, you want to like make sure that they know what time you're coming in and you're not just showing up and, just moving the patient when they need to be in there first and making sure everything's set up first. So, there's that. So if I'm mobilizing the patient, the nurse is in there just kind of walking with this drain that's literally in their head, so it can't be pulled out, like that would be bad. So it's definitely a more delicate line that I would want the nurse in there, unless the nurse is like, "I've clamped it, I'm sitting right outside, let me know if you need anything," that kind of thing. So it's both intense in the ICU, but also the treatments are going to be different. Like you're not going to be doing maybe a full like 45-minute session and going through all of the ADLs with the patient. It's going to look very different than, a med-surg floor. So first things first, just to recap what I've said already. First things first, make sure the nurse knows what time you're coming. Make sure the nurse can maybe pre-medicate the patient if needed. Make sure the nurse has time to be in there to manage the lines or the EVD, or anything else that needs to be managed. That's more of a nursing thing that like therapy can't handle. Also, it's a good idea when you're going to work with a patient, it's a good idea to ask the nurse if there's any line that they can disconnect. If there's any IV line that they can do like a little saline lock and then reconnect it when you're done working with them, because the less things that they're connected to, the better. That's how I feel. Usually, if you're going to mo move from like one part of the room to the next, there's like a portable monitor that's still reading their heart rate and blood pressure and all that stuff. And all of this, like a lot of this stuff I learned as I was doing it. I remember the first time I realized that like the screen had like a portable screen. It was with a therapy aide and she just like disconnected it. Like she took it off the, I don't know what to call it, like the main thing, and she just brought it with us when we probably walked to like the sink or something. And I was like, "Oh shoot, I didn't even know that you could take that off." So you learn a lot by just like watching other people. Also co-treating with physical therapy is really nice, because again, you have two clinicians, you have two people in there, and two people to kind of manage the lines and the patient. So anyway, yeah, if you can, if you have the resources, go up there with somebody, especially if it's like you're like a first time up there seeing a patient, have a therapy aide or another clinician in there with you if you can do a co-treat, and then just let the nurse know like, "Hey, if I need you, are you going to be around?" Just in case. And they're very, for the most part, like at least where I work, the ICU nurses are very sweet, very understanding, and very willing to help out and be there. And I've actually had some nurses that have been in the rooms the entire treatment session just helping out. And I'm like, this is great. To me, I love this because, again, I like having more people, more sets of eyes on the patient, especially if they're in the ICU for a reason. So they're more critically ill, maybe lower level, needing a lot more assistance. And so it's nice to have extra people in there, an extra set of hands. So there's that. There's a bunch of other things that I've seen in the ICU in terms of like lines and drains and stuff, which maybe I'll do another episode on. But this one I wanted to kind of talk about more about treatments. So it depends on what they're there for, of course. If they have precautions, that could limit your what you do with them, depending on what's going on, right? What I will do in the ICU, I mean, of course, I'm a CODA, I'm an assistant, so the OT has already been in there to see them and evaluate them and kind of get their status so far, their function, whether it's just bed mobility or a transfer. So I've already seen, I'm lucky where in that sense, because I've already seen the OT note and probably the PT note as well, where it shows like how they're standing at least. If I can see how they're standing or how they get out of bed, that's good enough for me. Even if they haven't transferred yet, I know that, like, okay, they stood with, let's say, Modicist. Okay, like, then I know kind of an idea of like how they might get to the chair. So if it's your first time going in to an ICU patient, of course you're going to do your full chart review. It depends on what they're there for. It depends on if they have precautions, things like that. But the biggest thing I'll do is just start by getting them to the edge of the bed if they're able to, and seeing how their vitals are. Now, I don't always, unless they're in there and they have a history for like orthostatic hypotension, or the last couple of nursing notes said that their blood pressure dropped or their blood pressure was really low, I won't, unless it's like a situation like that, I won't always like do the orthostatics with the patient unless they're symptomatic, or again, it's listed in their chart that they have these things. Otherwise, I will record, like, I will make a note of their blood pressure when I walked in, and then I will take their blood pressure when I leave, and I will put both of those things in my notes. And of course, if anything is looking a little out of sorts, if their blood pressure is like really, really low, or if it's really high, I'll just let the nurse know. We have what's called secure chat in my at my job in our documenting system, and so it's pretty easy to, like if there's a blood pressure that's a little high, but it's not like critically high, like it's not cr like crazy high, I'll just let them know through secure chat and just be like, hey, by the way, their blood pressure was this, or their blood pressure dropped a little bit when I got them up, things like that. Anything that you think is like, huh, then you should probably tell the nurse. And if it's totally within parameters, if they're not symptomatic at all, I'm not going to be bothering the nurse with what their blood pressure was for the session. But if they're, if their oxygen is dropping, then I'll call the nurse. Or if it dropped a little bit but then came up, then I'll let the nurse know later. So it's, you kind of have to use your clinical judgment with, where you think the patient is, like just from your assessment, like, and how the patient is feeling and if they're symptomatic. I've had patients who their heart rate is crazy high, but they're like not symptomatic at all, or their blood pressure drops a little bit, but they're not symptomatic at all. But I'll still let the nurse know because these are things that they need to know. This is a change, this might be a change from maybe the day before. They need to know if like a medication has to be adjusted, all of these things that like they need to know when we're getting their patient up. So, starting with getting to the edge of the bed, seeing how they do. If they're symptomatic, we check vitals again and we go from there. And if they're not and their vitals are fine, like their oxygen has been fine, their heart rate didn't like spike, to like the 140s when they get to the edge of the bed, then it's like, okay, let's try to stand, or let's maybe do some lower body dressing at the edge of the bed. It's really not so much different than a med-surg floor. You're using your clinical judgment. You are seeing where the patient's at. You're seeing how they feel. You're seeing what they're capable of. And you're being mindful of precautions and stuff. And you go from there. And in the ICU, oh my God, I totally lost what I was going to say. This happens all the time to me. I totally lost what I was going to say. Oh, well, I guess there was another point I was going to make about asking the patient what they would like to work on. If they're capable of answering that question, and if they're cognitively with it and stuff like that, I will go in, I'll explain what OT is. And then I'm like, okay, so I saw yesterday you got up and brushed your teeth at the sink. Like, great. Is there something you would like to work on today? And if they're like, no, I just want to get stronger, then it's like, okay, let's work on some sit to stands. Let's work on some functional mobility in the room. Like, and then if I offer like, hey, do you also want to get up to the sink and like wash your face, or do you have to use the bathroom? Then that way I can also see some ADLs. Not every session, I don't get to ADLs every session, and that's just the way it is. Sometimes all I can do is get them to the edge of the bed. And if that's all they can tolerate, then that's all we do. Sometimes my session has just been getting to the edge of bed and doing like two or three sit to stands and then getting them back to bed. It's not like, don't feel pressured to go through all the ADLs with these patients who sometimes just can't. Like, sometimes they just can't. And also a big thing about the ICU is patients can get what's called ICU delirium. So it's just like a change in their in their mentation, and they might seem confused and disoriented and they don't know where they are. And the ICU can be very disorienting. It can be loud depending on like what other patients are there. There's beeping noises. It's like overstimulating to people. And on top of that, people aren't getting enough sleep in the hospital, especially the ICU. And so all of this stuff kind of affects their mentation. So what we also do is we will go in and we'll screen for ICU. We'll do a, it's called a CAM ICU. And the CAM stands for Confusion Assessment Method, I believe. And then there's also something called a RASS score, RASS, that we use to measure their level of like, what is it? It's Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale. Wow. I thought I was going to forget that for a second. So we see kind of like where they're at and if they're agitated or if they're like completely zonked, you know, and like drowsy even, or alert and calm is one of the scores. And so we use that assessment. Also, the nurses use that assessment as well. But since OT kind of looks at cognition and all of, and you know, just how their mentation is, because that obviously affects our treatments and stuff, we've also been at my hospital starting to assess that. And if you don't know what that is, I would totally encourage you to look it up. Look up the RASS score and then look up the CAM ICU. There's a like a PDF online that shows, it's a quick assessment to see if they are positive or negative for delirium. And I would definitely incorporate that into your treatments on top of the regular orientation questions, seeing if they're alert and oriented times, you know, three or four or whatever, wherever they're at. You can also do your additional like cognitive screens or assessments in the ICU as well. But yeah, I mean, so the moral of the story is that every patient is going to be different. Every treatment session is going to look different. I do not pressure myself to do a bunch of ADLs unless I know that the patient is capable, willing, and, you know, it's safe to do so. So sometimes I will just focus on neuro reeducation in the chair or in bed, you know, if they're not able to get to the edge of the bed, whatever it is. And I kind of figure things out after I see the patient for the first time. It's usually only after I've seen them for the first time that I have a plan for the next day. But when I've never even met them, and I don't even know like what they look like, all I have is like how they did in the previous, you know, OT, like the eval, then I'm not going in there with like a rigid plan of like, we need to do this, this, and this, because it's not always feasible in the ICU. So yeah, I think I would love to, get your guys' feedback on this episode. And if you guys have any, specific like patients that you're working with and you're like, oh my gosh, I just don't know what to do with this person in the acute care setting. They're in the ICU. I just don't know what to do. Then please message me, find me on Instagram. If you don't already follow me, and let me know your questions, because I would love to problem solve that with you and kind of brainstorm with you. It's easy for me to just be like, to put like a blanket statement, like everybody's different, so you'll figure it out. But if you have like specific patients or specific scenarios where you're like, this is what I did, but I wish I did more, or whatever, let me know and we can brainstorm together. And then, like I said, I might do another episode on like the different things that you might come across in the ICU. And that one I will do an outline for, and I'll have a plan of what to say. okay. Well, I think that concludes this episode. I look forward to doing more of these, you know, treatment-based podcast episodes. So, all right, guys, till next time. Bye.